Welcome to the Biomedical Frontiers Podcast, where we explore pivotal research projects and disruptive innovations aimed at translating scientific advancements into tangible healthcare solutions. I'm your host, Dasha Tischler.
If you've been following the news, you've probably heard about Virginia's growing biotech investments and a big push that they're doing for building up the biotech ecosystem across the entire region and leading to more discoveries in medicine. And so today we're going to talk about this. We're speaking with Dr. Mark Esser, who's the chief science officer and head of the UVA's Paul and Diane Manning Institute of Biotechnology. His team is building one of the most ambitious translational research engines in the country, designed to turn groundbreaking science into therapies that reach patients. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Well, thank you, Dasha. It's a pleasure to be here and always excited to talk about the Manning Institute of Biotechnology.
Yeah, this is a really exciting time, and I'm really excited to help share the vision. But I want to start with a case study so that we can get really deep into, like, what is this going to look like? Could you give us something that you guys might be already be working on or planning?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, in addition to building a 350,000 square foot building, serving as a general contractor, we're building molecules that will hopefully make a difference in not just treating, but curing disease. And before the building opens, we've already recruited some an amazing talent. And one of those people to highlight is a gentleman, Jinji Ma, who's actually come up with a therapeutic protein. Maybe some of your audience is savvy enough to know what a monoclonal antibody is, but to help treat sepsis. And many people are familiar with sepsis. It's a life-threatening condition, one of the leading causes of death and intensive care units and emergency rooms, mortality rates north of 33%.
So and Jinji, loss of limb too, and things like that.
Yeah, yeah. So Jinji and his team have discovered an antibody in their kind of basic research that they've now translated. They've actually made this antibody that prevents the inflammation from the innate immune system. They've humanized it. They've actually been able to produce it, and they'll be starting clinical trials early next year. And this is just one example, hopefully, of in the future, many examples of the type of work that we hope to do at the Manning Institute here at the University of Virginia.
So how does that work? Was this developed within UVA and now it's translating into the Institute, or is the Institute sort of sponsoring? How does the relationship work between kind of the academic research part and then the translation at the Institute?
It's still a little bit of a work in progress, building the plane as we're flying it, or flying the building as we're building it. I don't know. We'll have to play with that analogy, Dasha. But it's really about bringing in researchers that have that translational mindset, that are going to take the work that they do in basic biomedical discovery and see if they can come up with solutions that they can then apply to the human condition. And that's clearly the mission of the Manning Institute, is to have many more researchers like Jinji Ma with a focus of simply transforming science into medicines. So in the future, we hope to have a full suite of services in the building to provide researchers with the end-to-end capabilities to take those ideas and really translate them, just not just from an idea, but into an actual molecule that we can take into clinical trials. Happy to unpack that. There's a lot behind that, but that's where we'll be going over the next few years.
Well, maybe we can unpack Jinji Ma's example. You mentioned you're taking it into clinical trials. Like, what's the role of the Institute in this process, and what kind of support, help, what's the team looking like? And then also, how is that different from somebody just developing it and not having this kind of infrastructure and backing that you're building behind them?
Yeah, so right now it's mostly providing some at least regulatory support, and then hopefully some financial support to Jinji and his team as we go forward. And again, in the future, we hope to have everything from toxicology and pharmacology and formulations and protein engineering all within the Institute to support researchers like Jinji and many others here at UVA. The other thing that's a little bit adjacent to the Manning Institute proper is partnering with our licensing and ventures group that helped him to create a company. And then also working with funding agencies here in Virginia to provide some of those small business initiative grants to start companies to actually do this type of work. And I think Junji is a great example because he's done all of the above. He's actually created a company. He's gotten money from one of the Virginia Go development and accelerator funds and actually done the regulatory work to get permission from the FDA to take this molecule into clinical trials. So I think he's a great example of what we aspire to be doing at the Manning Institute in the years ahead.
That's excellent. And then on the technology itself, because this is so, it's so intriguing because sepsis is, it's like one of those problems that's been so intractable and yet recognized as a massive issue through so much of history. Even in high school, when you're learning about ancient history, you talk about sepsis as one of the kind of key killers of people in the battlefield and under very difficult field conditions. From a technology and research perspective, what's been the new discovery that's leading to us being to feel confident that we might actually have a solution for sepsis?
Yeah, I mean, it's really some breakthrough research that Junji and his team did, and they looked at acetylation of a molecule called histone 3. And this molecule creates what are called neutrophil nets, are in part of netosis, and are part of the inflammatory cascade that can lead to sepsis. So it's really kind of catching it in the upstream part of the disease process. It's a target that no one's ever worked on before. So it's new, it's different. And at least in animal models, looks really good that it could provide benefit to patients. Now, many things have looked good in animal models that haven't played out in humans. It's the nature of biomedical research. And that's why we run these placebo-controlled clinical trials to show things have benefits in humans. But I think it's really a novel pathway. It's some new insights, and it's a very different approach to tackling, as you said, something that's been a really intractable problem for decades.
That's so interesting. When you have something that is such an intractable problem and very difficult to make the right discovery to figure out exactly what's causing or what's going to work, it makes me think a little bit of like the light bulb discovery process where you have to have 1,000 failed light bulbs to get the one that succeeds, but then the benefit is light for all humanity. So it's worth those failed attempts, even though it's risky, to get to the one that works. Okay, so...
Yeah. Kind of just to add a little color to that, I hate using the F word in science. So I don't call those experiments a failure. If it's a well-thought-out hypothesis, and it's a well-controlled experiment, whether that's in the laboratory or clinical trial, we need to follow the science. So if it's done well and we get a clear result, I call that a success.
Well, that's right. It's advancing knowledge. And sometimes we have unexpected knowledge that comes out of things. You expect to see something and you see something else and you might not even know yet how it's applicable, but it's adding the pieces to the puzzle. Yeah. So
no, actually,
absolutely right.
Let me steal that from you down the road, Dasha, because as much as I hope to be sitting here in a few years talking about some of our impact that we've made on patients and new clinical trials with medicines coming out of the Manning Institute, you know, one of our core missions still being part of the university is to advance knowledge and do that research to create new knowledge and new information that will hopefully advance humanity. That's a core mission of the university, and we're part of that greater mission.
Yeah, that's great. So let's talk about the greater mission. Tell me a little bit about you're transforming science into medicine. Can you break that down into your words? And then how does that then translate into what you will be doing overall?
Yeah, no, thank you. So I kind of always say, if your listeners only remember one thing after our interview, and that's the mission of the Manning Institute, and that's to really transform science into medicine. And it should serve as a catalyst for both the biomedical research and innovation, but equally, and sometimes unapologetically, really be a catalyst for economic growth here in Virginia. So if you kind of think of that house with the transforming science into medicine, sort of three pillars holding it up. And fortunately, they rhyme and they spell the ACE acronym. And so we got accelerate, create, and educate. So I'll kind of touch on those in that order. So the accelerate piece is what we just talked about. How do we take those biomedical discoveries and really accelerate them to the clinic and get them into those all important clinical trials, not in 5 years, not in 3 years, but can we do it in 2 years? And talk a little bit how to do that. But really the first goal is to accelerate drug discovery and development to really improve human lives. The middle part, the create, is kind of twofold. One, we're going to create new molecules that never existed before. We're going to be using AI, transformational science, medicinal chemistry, genetic engineering, genomic medicines, cell and gene therapies, really creating new molecules and new intellectual property, which really becomes the bedrock and foundation for creating new medicines. And if we do that right, we're going to create entrepreneurs that are going to take those molecules and hopefully start new companies and new initiatives to move them into the clinic. So that's kind of the create component. And then the last, which maybe should be the first, is the educate. So we got accelerate, create, and educate. As I mentioned, we're part of the larger mission of educating future leaders here at the University of Virginia. But I think in the Manning Institute, we really have an opportunity to expand that mission and not just educate undergrads and graduate students, but really partner with our colleagues at community colleges, regional universities, to create a workforce that can tackle just the demands of the bioeconomy, which is coming fast and furiously to Virginia. You know, some of your listeners may know that between AstraZeneca, Eli Lilly, and Merck, and some other companies, there's more than $12.5 billion, emphasize that billion, dollars of investment coming to this region to really grow the biopharmaceutical industry. So they're going to need talent across the spectrum, and we're going to be a big part of that, working with partners across the state to, again, hopefully attract and retain the next generation of talent.
Oh, I have so many questions. One, you just mentioned is these companies that are coming into Virginia. What's making Virginia special? Why are they all choosing this region to specifically all get into at one time? What's happening?
Yeah. You know, I can't speak for them, but having spent the last 25 years working for some of those companies like Merck and AstraZeneca, I used to say two things would keep me up at night, or two pipelines. One, of course, was ensuring we had a robust drug discovery and development pipeline as a leader in R&D. But the second, and maybe more importantly, was the people development pipeline. In any organization, people are your most important resource or asset. Sometimes people forget that, but people are most important. And in an innovation, technology-driven industry, it's all about the war for talent. And I think Virginia just has, I think, a plethora of talent. We have great universities between UVA, Virginia Tech, VCU, GMU to the north, friends at ODU, some of the regional community colleges. I think there's a wealth of talent here that you can build an ecosystem around. And it's frankly a pretty, Charlottesville in particular has got an entrepreneurial kind of business friendly vibe. I think that's also attractive. You have the right culture to do this type of work.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Now I just love to hear that, because having gone to UVA and having thought that I had received a fantastic education and seen the energy there, it's rewarding to know that other people are seeing that energy there too. And they're thinking this is really worth investing into. I really love that. And at the very beginning, you mentioned you're building a 30,000 square foot building. Did I say that correctly?
Close, add another zero, 350,000.
350,000. All right, let's add a zero and a 50,000 to that. Can you talk about how that fits with the mission and then this ACE acronym, Accelerate, Create, Educate?
Yeah, and let me back up. You know, we're just talking a little bit about ecosystems. We love to talk about ecosystems in the bioeconomy. But what does it really take to have a successful ecosystem? So first and foremost, we already touched on, and that's talent. And specifically young talent, innovation, creativity tends to be the specialty of the young and energetic. Love to have you come back to Charlottesville, by the way. So that's kind of number one. There is a plethora of talent here in Charlottesville and in this state. I think equally you need the capital, the money, to invest in this is a very expensive endeavor. We just talked about more than $12.5 billion. This doesn't include the more than $120 million the state will be investing in training. I think third, specifically in the bioeconomy, is you need some regulatory expertise. And that's kind of a unique skill set. Fortunately, we're proximal to DC and the FDA. It's not too far away. And then the fourth is actually the environment, the location. And so I think one of the rationales for building the Manning Institute, this huge facility at 350,000 square feet, is to get all this, these people with diverse backgrounds in one building, in one location at the Fontaine Research Park, to hopefully attract others to the research park, where you're not just going to have departments segregated by degrees. We're going to have folks from chemical engineering, biology, medicine, the School of Data Science, the business school, licensing and ventures, School of Medicine. I feel like I forgot somebody, but really bringing in this kind of cross-disciplinary, cross-functional group of folks to work on big problems like brain cancer, pediatric leukemia, Alzheimer's. And I think having that environment that brings folks together is one of the key ingredients to have a recipe of success. And part of that, we'll have a really world-class conference center in the Manning Institute and hopefully bring folks to. And my joke is we'll have an amazing kind of employee lounge with a coffee kiosk and a restaurant with a pizza oven. The idea is to bring folks together. Drug development's a team sport.
Yeah, coffee's very important, I think.
Absolutely. It's a key ingredient.
Key ingredient. No, I think you're echoing something that's been said several times on this podcast, also about UVA's biomedical engineering department. One of the things we've talked about in the past, I think on more than one occasion with people, has been how critical it is, that bridge between the BME department and the medical school, the indoor bridge, not the fact that you can just go across, but the fact that you can navigate through. It brings the physicians and the engineers together, and how that moment, just the fact that they can like eat in the same lunchroom, is already such a important aspect of being able to do translation. So the idea of co-locating entrepreneurs, business background people with the scientists and engineers working on things, with the regulatory people, who are that in and of itself, the spark for creating new things, and also the spark for, okay, what's the real next step here? How do we project plan this? Oh, grabbing an expert isn't hunting down a busy person and getting lost in their inbox. It's walking down a hallway and knocking on the door, or having a coffee together in the lunchroom, maybe even serendipitously. I think that's fantastic. That's so important. And I think a lot of people are so virtual nowadays that we forget how much you can achieve by just putting people together in the same area. So I really like that. And I think having
I like to say, if drug discovery and development's a team sport, it's also a contact sport. Sometimes you're banging heads, which can healthy disagreement is always constructive, but no, it's truly bringing people together. That's where the magic happens, and been working with the architects and the team to create an environment where it's going to be a great place to work and belong, and people are going to want to be there and be part of the interaction and action in the Institute. It should be fun.
So are there also going to be like startups and companies in there, or is it once you're spun out, you're outside the building, or is it in the building?
Great question. And actually something I'm working on as we speak. If I get my way, we'll be able to have some incubator space and some really nascent startups in the physical building. I'm really working hard to create an environment where we could have incubators in the actual Manning Institute, because for the reasons you just said, knowledge usually moves with the person. And having that investigator, often a postdoc, grad student, being able to remain proximal to the main lab is very key in the early stages of development.
Yeah, yeah. And then is there also going to be some manufacturing that's happening there?
Yeah, and I think that's what makes the Manning Institute unique. If you look at other sort of biomedical research centers and institutes across the country, the Manning Institute is really laid out, I was going to say like a biotech company, but it's so big. It looks like a good size, at least mid-sized biopharmaceutical company. So we have 30,000 square feet set aside for GMP manufacturing space. And this can be for biologics, cell and gene therapy. We're still programming it out. And then well over, 150,000 square feet of lab space, in addition to conference rooms, team rooms, and stuff. Yeah, it's going to look and feel like, in many respects, a biopharmaceutical company, because all those capabilities from medicinal chemistry, protein engineering, GMP manufacturing, and then providing some of that project management support will all be located right in the same building.
Yeah, that is very unique. And I think it's so important because even talking to like medical device companies, setting up the manufacturing to be compliant and to have great quality systems and the softwares that you have to track all the things. And it's a huge investment. And it's one of those humps that it's difficult to get over from both a talent perspective and the right facilities and the right amount of funding, that it can seem so far down the line when you're starting, but then when you hit that point, it can really delay projects and cause a lot of problems if you don't have it set up right. But to have somebody who can help manage and create a kind of a center of excellence even, and to ensure that even that expertise exists in the region, so that if somebody else setting up their manufacturing space, you're like, they've got one over here and it's 30,000 square feet. So you can go and learn from them. You're not going outside the region trying to find experts who could come and travel in or whatever. I think that having that will have widespread impact beyond just the institute itself too, because that's going to bring all that expertise in-house into this region and make those people available to ask questions of and help others. So I can see that. Okay, well, I want to talk about something, the valley of death, and we just talked about one of the challenges of starting a biotech company is the manufacturing, but you mentioned this kind of valley of death in translating research into medicine. And I wanted to find out, first of all, what is that valley of death? How do we understand it?
Yeah, it's affectionately known as the translational valley of death. And it's the space between having a really good idea and some initial validation around a biological target or a process, and then actually doing the hard work of creating a molecule that can impact that pathway or process and improve disease. So historically, the NIH has always funded sort of basic biomedical research and then a lot of clinical trials. But this kind of middle step, which has been done by drug companies less and less today, you can talk a little bit about that. But the idea of going from identifying a lead molecule, optimizing it, doing some of the what often feels rote work of pharmacology, biodistribution, metabolism, pharmacokinetics, formulation, coming up with a process to make it that's frankly scalable and affordable. There's a lot of work that goes into those steps that frankly are not going to get you on the cover of Science, Cell, or Nature. They're not the exciting science that makes the headlines, but it's a lot of the basic work that needs to be done to get something to a point where you could file what's called an investigational new drug application with the FDA. And that's the permission slip to run, test the molecule in humans. And it's a unique set of skills and expertise that we're going to bring together at the Manning Institute, either ourselves or in partnership with companies specializing in this space. But equally, and maybe more importantly, is creating an innovation fund to fund that type of work. And I know the BME group has the Coulter Fund, which is pretty similar. I think it expands beyond just drug discovery and development. It covers devices and diagnostics and things. But we're going to have one dedicated just to pure drug discovery and development to help fund that type of work to truly transform a molecule into a medicine. Because something I learned early on is not every molecule is going to become a medicine. There's a lot of work that goes in to do that.
Yeah, you mentioned a lot of things, pharmacology and biochemistry. And are there things that, when you're looking at that educate part of the pillars that you mentioned, where you see particular strengths in the region in the bringing the molecule to become a medicine? And are there areas where you see that there's gaps and we need to invest more in the education and the preparation of the workforce?
Yeah, no, thank you. In terms of the Manning Institute strategy, our first approach will be going from strength to strength to build upon the great science, basic science and clinical science that already goes on here at the University of Virginia. Many of your listeners will know that our cancer center is one of the premier cancer centers in the country. It's an NCI designated comprehensive cancer center, which is the highest rating. And so we'll continue to build upon that. Cancer research is one of our key areas of investment. I think neuroscience and brain science, after the foundation of the Brain Institute that's led by Udeep Kapoor, is another area where the university has invested significantly over the last decade. So we'll continue to invest in sort of brain science and trying to develop medicines against neurodegenerative diseases. And then a little biased, I think the Immunology Center is really strong. I trained in the Immunology Center many years ago, but I think Colleen McNamara has done a fantastic job of really taking it to the next level. And then the Cardiovascular Research Center under the leadership of Gary Owens is really strong. So we have a strong foundation to build upon. It is the reason I wanted to highlight that. And then there are some areas of investment, everything from the GMP manufacturing suite. We mentioned some things like pharmacology, toxicology, formulation, medicinal chemistry, biologics engineering. We'll be investing in those key areas really as accelerants to help move these molecules towards the clinic. And then in parallel, really developing a biotech curriculum so students can learn everything from bioinformatics to biologics engineering to medicinal chemistry to bioprocess engineering. And my vision is to almost have an a la carte menu where students can pick and choose tracks within this very wide spectrum of classes to learn about biotechnology and biomedical drug development.
Yeah, that's fantastic. It's great that there's also such a variety of strengths to draw on as well. Now, you also mentioned before this SPARC program for how you move academic projects towards the clinic. Could you describe that a little bit? How does that work and where does that come from?
Yeah, we're not the first to try and do this. I think we're doing some things new and differently, one from how the building's organized to our funding models. But I think the leaders who've probably done the best job of really translating basic biomedical research into medicines and devices is Stanford University, obviously, out in California. And Daria Rosen and Kevin Grimes actually have written a textbook entitled How to Do Drug Discovery and Development in Academia. I tell folks I've read it twice, and they've created what they call the SPARC program, which is really a training program on how to do this. So I've talked with them a bunch of times. I went to their SPARC International meeting back in October. And we're going to sign up to be a SPARC affiliate and basically use their programming and project management model to do this type of work at UVA. And it spans everything from how do you organize those early drug discovery and development teams? I think you touched on it. BME does something very similar. You need a scientist or an engineer to be partnered with a clinician to come together, throw in some business expertise in that kind of core drug discovery and development team. The funding model, and then what's different between basic biomedical research is you have some sort of governance around it and basically what's called milestone-based funding. You don't just get a blank check for 3 years to go do research. Here's a tranche of money. Go see if you can move the molecule from point A to point B. If you're successful, fantastic. Here's another tranche of money to get you from point B to point C. If it doesn't work out, no worries. Get back on the horse, come up with your next big idea, and we'll see you again to fund it. It's a very different kind of funding model than, say, a traditional NIH grant.
Yeah, it sounds almost like an SBIR phase one, phase two kind of concept where it's different things that you do at each stage and this kind of process of elimination between them. And also, like typical startup funding, investors do have a little bit of, here's what we expect at pre-seed, seed, if you're not on a trajectory between this and this, we're not really ready to invest. So I would say sometimes in our minds, science might sound like something a little bit more emergent. And how does that SPARC model and the milestone-based funding structure, how does that work with the kind of emergent elements of science where things are, as we talked about, maybe less? Sometimes you're not entirely yet clear if you're in the mode of success or learning. How is it adaptive to science in a way that's different how we kind of think about startup investing?
Yeah. And you know, when I tell folks, it's not an either or, it's an and, right? We're going to continue to do basic biomedical research that's a little bit more following the science and some kind of project-based, project-funded research. And again, it's not an either or, it's an and. We're going to do both. And it's not to say, you could give you many examples, you're going down a path trying to discover or develop something and you have to pivot. That's kind of most every entrepreneur tells a story of having to pivot. And we just want to create that flexibility, you know, the culture and the frankly, the funding environment to allow people to do that.
So one question is, we've talked about why Virginia, why there's companies coming into Virginia, but why is this institute being established in Charlottesville at UVA? What drove that?
At the most basic level, it was really the brainchild of Paul Manning, who obviously the institute's named after. I think he gave one of the largest philanthropy gifts ever to UVA, $100 million to start the institute. And this was done in partnership with the Economic Development Commerce Secretary in Virginia, and then the third partner, of course, being the University of Virginia. So I think the time was right. Again, we have a strong foundation, great basic biomedical science and clinical care here at UVA. So you have all the elements. I think what we needed was the capital, the money, and frankly, the environment or the infrastructure to bring folks together to do it. And then I think we touched a few minutes ago, I think there's just a huge base of talent here in terms of young researchers. Some of the best and brightest undergrads in the country come to UVA. And how do we tap into that to really advance basic and applied biomedical research?
Yeah, that's awesome. What a great thing. Now, you've also mentioned before, one of the ways that you've done the visioning for the Institute and trying to figure out how you're going to employ this vision and mission was to figure out what would the moonshot look like? What's 5-10 years from now? What's going to be the headline you're going to be writing?
We're really about improving people's lives, hopefully curing them of disease, but if not, at least improving their condition. And we've already crafted the headline that in 2030, the first medicine to come out of the building or the new Manning Institute will enter clinical trials here at UVA. Not picking a disease area, maybe it's an oncology, maybe it's neuroscience, immunology, cardiovascular, maybe even something else. But, and I love the idea that it comes out of UVA, the Manning Institute, and that the clinical trial will also be here at UVA as part of that kind of moonshot, which means will not only be our researchers, chemists, biologists, but actually our clinicians working together with regulators to start up the study here. So I think that would be incredibly rewarding if we pull it off. A lot of my friends are like, that's not a long time. I'm like, I know.
How many projects do you guys think you'll be doing, you know, and in any span of time, maybe within 1 year, how many you might be going on simultaneously, or do you have a sense of kind of volume that you're striving for within the next
year? Yeah, I think in the near term, we'd like to have kind of a Shark Tank competition in June of next year. I think we're organizing ourselves, looking at the portfolio of potential projects. I think right now, with not a lot of organization, to be honest, there's probably about a dozen pretty interesting molecules that could potentially be a medicine one day. So that's not a bad place to start, just going through freezers and talking to people. In June, I'd love to have a competition and pick our top five. And then they could get one of these milestone-based grants or seed money in the tune of $250,000 to $500,000 to start a med chem or biologics engineering campaign, et cetera, to move to start on that journey. It's steady state. Would love to have probably 15 to 20 projects or programs running at any time, with the ultimate goal of 2 to 3 molecules entering clinical trials every year. And that would be fully operational. It'll take us a long time to get there, but you could see the milestones along the way of what we need to do. And I think having that first one will be, well, one, incredibly rewarding, but 2, energizing to the organization to prove to people we can do it.
Yeah, that's a lot of projects. That's really great. But it's ambitious, but it's good to see where you guys are headed and what that impact is going to look like. I'm going to have to, I don't know if you have the details of that Shark Tank competition, but I'm very curious about a Shark Tank competition, but for small molecules. Is it going to be like, is there going to be judges and they're going to be pushing buttons, or are you thinking more, you know, what are your thoughts in terms of how do you structure that? Is it going to be kind of like fun? Is it?
Yeah, I mean, you got to make it fun, or life should be fun. It's a lot of hard work. You know, I've done these before in my former companies. I've seen one that Nikki Hastings ran here at the Seville Biohub. But run it like the TV show. You have folks come in, they can give their kind of 5 to 10 minute pitch and answer some questions, you know, really thinking about a target product profile, where's the unmet medical need, the commercial opportunity, the probability of technical and regulatory success. You think of the 5 R's in terms of the right target, right pharmacology, right safety, right patient, et cetera, and then have a score. And the top 5 would be the winners. Obviously have judges. There's so much experience. Actually, here in Charlottesville, believe it or not, there's a lot of retired ex-biotech pharma people in the area that would love to be a judge and help out on these sorts of things, and then coach and mentor people along the way. But plenty of alumni and have also reached out about willing to help high level, but we'll make it fun and exciting, and maybe you can be here for it. That would be pretty cool.
Yeah, it's a beautiful time to be in Charlottesville.
Well, that's part of this, you know, inviting some judges to fly in from Boston and California, ex-alumni that are in kind of the pharma biotech space, make it enjoyable, and then dream big, have it at one of the local vineyards or something.
Well, I want to also, you mentioned a couple times where you've worked before, you mentioned you've run these types of pitch competitions before as well. Can you share a little bit about your path and journey, starting from when you were at UVA to all the things you've done, and then how did you end up heading this institute?
Yeah, I'm going to keep it brief. I was here, believe it, 30 years ago. I got my PhD in immunology from the microbiology and immunology department. And just to kind of plant a flag, when I started graduate school in the 90s, if someone was diagnosed with HIV, it was basically a death sentence. There was no medicines. There was no treatments. There wasn't even hope on the horizon. And from there, went on to the AIDS vaccine program at the NIH, which was really driving a lot of immunology research in the late 90s. And then from there, went to Merck, Merck Pharmaceuticals and Merck Research Labs, thinking I'd work on an HIV vaccine. Became friends with a lot of the folks working on some of the antiretrovirals. And it was incredibly exciting to see some of the first nucleoside, non-nucleoside, and then protease inhibitors that had come out of Merck Research Labs at that time truly benefit patients. And if you think about today, fast forward 30 years, patients will live a long and healthy life if they take their antiretroviral medicines basically twice a year now, and they can keep the virus completely in check and undetectable. And it's just an example of how biomedical basic research can translate into drug discovery and development to really impact people's lives, to go from something that was a plague that there was no hope for, and now it's completely manageable. But I didn't get to work on an HIV vaccine. I got tapped to work on a different virus called HPV, or human papillomavirus, and was fortunate enough to be on the scientific team to develop a pretty important vaccine called Gardasil, which prevents cervical and head and neck cancers, one of the better known vaccines. And that was incredibly exciting and rewarding to take it all the way from research into clinical trials, and then followed it all the way through FDA approval and commercial launch, and got to do stuff with the CDC and the WHO and do some really incredible things along the way. Through some turn of events, I ended up at a biotech company called MedImmune in Gaithersburg, Maryland. I always say they were either brave enough or foolish enough to keep working on another deadly virus called RSV, or respiratory syncytial virus, and at the time, the leading cause of pneumonias and hospitalizations in infants. and got to develop a, after three failures, actually, three vaccines that did not work, developed a monoclonal antibody, a therapeutic to prevent RSV in newborn infants. And that was incredibly rewarding. It was more than 85% effective in preventing RSV pneumonias in babies. I would say, most importantly, my granddaughter got a dose last year. So these medicines really make an impact on not just the patients we serve, but family and friends too. So it's very personal. And along the way, I actually led Operation Warp Speed for the therapeutic program at AstraZeneca, helped develop a medicine called Evusheld. Kind of joke, that's where most of my gray hair came from, leading that program through COVID. But I got that through emergency use authorization and getting it to patients that needed it. And these were like transplant patients, cancer patients, et cetera. Had a great run. A ton of friends, was doing great. And I ended up sitting with Bill Petrie, one of our professors here, at a dinner in Washington, D.C. It was one of these kind of black tie affairs. And he mentioned the Manning Institute. And I was like, wow, that sounds pretty cool and pretty exciting. And then it's a once in a lifetime opportunity to really build an organization from scratch. You know, I like to say I got in on the ground level, but technically it was a basement level. It was a big hole in the ground when I got here. And now seeing the building, we put the last steel beam up on the tower back in October. So it's coming together. We're recruiting. So yeah, it's a big adventure. It's a ton of fun. I like challenges, and I got to say, this is one of the biggest challenges I've ever taken on. So it keeps me energized.
What's been the thing that you found the most challenging in your journey so far leading the Institute?
Well, I'll be frank. Like all big construction projects, it's a little short on cash. So I spend a fair amount of my time talking with folks down in Richmond, and actually from some of our alumni, donor base, and philanthropy, raising money to help finish the building. I don't know, that's been a surprise. Yeah.
How much more are you guys needing to raise?
Yeah, well, since you asked, we're about $150 million to go to complete the building. And for any of your listeners that are able and generous, there's plenty of naming opportunities as we start to build out some of the cancer center, immunology, autoimmune, neuroscience centers too. Yeah, that one caught me a little bit by surprise. Other than that, it's interesting how similar, there's more similarities than differences between a big pharma and actually working at a big university. That was also a surprise, but maybe I guess a pleasant surprise, because it's sort of a very similar system in how things are organized, decisions are made, how to get things done. So that's been easier than I expected.
Is it the nature of the size of the organization, or is it like the kind of research? Like what do you think is the similarity kind of based on?
I mean, you answered it. The two things. One, you know, the research areas of focus and interest overlap almost entirely. It's just different stages of the discovery and development process. If you think about it, what Big Pharma is really good at is scaling things and commercializing and distribution. I often like to say, I don't think I made this up, but I can't know who to give a credit to, is like, if you think of a product development journey, you got to nail it, scale it, and sail it. So nail it's that innovation, that's that creativity, that's that spark to come up with a better solution to a problem. That's what university professors and postdocs and grad students are incredibly good at. We touched a few minutes ago on the scale it part. That's hard. Most organizations actually trip up and fail at the scale it stage because there's a lot of unknown unknowns for certainly entrepreneurs. But that's where industry is really good. They've harnessed years of expertise. They know what it takes to scale things, not just from a production point of view, but from clinical trials, worldwide distribution, et cetera. And then the sale it part is, how do you truly commercialize and market something, which of course, any large company, that's going to be an area of focus. So I think the disease areas overlap quite similarly. It's just Big Pharma is really focused in the clinical trial space, and I think academia and biotech is more focused in the early discovery and development space. And then to your second point, yeah, big pharma, university are very large organizations, you know, tens of thousands of people. So you have to build structures and governance processes to manage a large portfolio of activities. And in that sense, the university is far more complex than a big pharmaceutical company because they're doing everything from educating undergrads and running a big hospital system to managing semi-pro / pro sports teams. It's quite a diverse portfolio.
Yeah, and their alums too.
Yeah, yeah. And everything in between.
Yeah. It sounds like you're going to be bringing some focus to the translation piece of it, at least, because you're going to be focusing on specific areas of research, specific platform technologies. So I want to get into that a little bit too. How did you choose, you know, we talked about strengths. Are there other reasons for choosing the five disease focus areas? And also, what other things are you doing to focus in the mission into specific types of technologies and specific types of research?
No, thank you. One of the most important decisions, I would argue the most important decision any leader in an organization makes, either large or small, is the areas of focus. And not just being clear on what you're saying yes to, but equally and probably more important is what you're saying no to. It's easy to say yes to really good things. Nobody disagrees with you, but it's really, really hard to say no to good things. So we've spent the first couple of months, you know, just talking to folks and really landing on that mission statement of transforming science into medicines. And I think everybody's like, yeah, that's great. That makes sense. But equally, we're not transforming science into better diagnostics. We're not transforming science into better imaging technologies. And we're not transforming science into, say, better public policy. And those things are all really, really important. They're really good. I've done some of those things in my own career. I like diagnostics and sort of precision medicine. It's super cool. But I think the power of focus, to really focus in being a pure play drug discovery and development institute, will be key to our success. So kind of to answer your question, focus is the first rule.
Yeah, that's great. And are there other areas that you're focusing in other than like the disease areas and obviously the medicines focus of it?
Yeah. So, you know, once we kind of landed on those key disease areas, the next body of work that we're doing is really deciding where to focus on technology platforms and everything from medicinal chemistry to protein engineering to viral vectors, to theranostics, to genomic medicines. I feel like I forgot something, but there's a lot of different technology platforms to invest in, and cell therapies, of course. So what are the ones that we're going to invest in as research grade level, and then maybe look to partner with folks, versus what are we really going to invest in the institute to be able to manufacture there? So I'll give you two examples that we've worked through. Others are work in progress. So let's take medicinal chemistry. We actually have some outstanding medicinal chemists here at Virginia. Folks like Yetse Tepe and Marco Perez are really doing some cool stuff, like designing molecules against multi-drug resistant bacteria, to proteasomes, to treat neurodegenerative disorders, to Felon Mertz Muhammad doing some stuff on protein degraders for new cancer therapies. If they're fortunate enough to have something that looks pretty interesting that could go into a clinical trial, and I'm confident they will, we don't need to do the process chemistry to scale it up here and manufacture it, because there's a group at Virginia Commonwealth University under the leadership of Frank Gupta called the Medicines for All Institute, that's what they do. So we would partner with them to actually produce or manufacture the medicine. And this is part of the larger kind of Virginia Research Diamond collaborative network that we're building. So that, I think that's one clear example. We'll have medicinal chemistry. We'll have chemists. We really hope to discover some new molecular entities, but then we can partner with VCU. I think the converse would be like biologics engineering. Pretty sure we'll build out like an AI protein design engineering and production kind of state-of-the-art facility to actually go from blueprints to making proteins to purifying and characterizing them as potential drugs, and actually do that end to end in the institute, and then be able to walk them downstairs into the cell lines to manufacture and produce them for clinical trials. Because right now that capability doesn't exist anywhere in Virginia. So I'm pretty confident we'll build that out. It comes at a pretty considerable cost, but I think there's a need there and an opportunity to be the best at that. Other things like cell and gene therapy, we're going to have to pick and choose and make some smart investments, but that's what the larger team is working on.
Yeah, that's great. You've laid out such a clear, both strategically what you guys are focusing on and why, and then also how you're collaborating. Are there things that people in the region who are entrepreneurs or maybe leaders of other institutes or other research groups, is there something that they should know about how to get involved if they feel like these areas of technologies, these areas of focus are something that they have interesting technologies in? Is that now, you know, other than the Shark Tank we talked about, we'll probably need to promote that before June. How do people reach out and get involved with that?
Yeah, I mean, early days, take folks that are super excited can just track me down, reach out to me. Simple email, just mark.esser@virginia.edu. You can also connect through our licensing and ventures group if they're looking more to see what's in the portfolio for potentially licensing opportunities. It's run by Rich Chilla. They have a well-oiled machine over there in their organization. And then just in terms of just the overall innovation process, Mike Lennox here, he had created the Innovation Studio. And now a fellow, Paul Cherikuri, has just joined us in the last few months as our Chief Innovation Officer. And we hope that we'll be investing in that and obviously partnering with him and that group to create maybe a formal curriculum, but at minimum some workshops and lectures on how to truly be an innovator in this space. So everyone stay tuned.
Fantastic. And then on the workforce development between the Institute and then this $12 billion of pharmaceutical company investments into the region with, I'm guessing, offices and labs and manufacturing, what should we expect in terms of workforce preparation generally in Virginia? And then specifically, how's the Institute participating with that?
If your listeners are hanging with us, and I remember the ACE acronym of Accelerate, Create, and Educate. And I said educate maybe should be number one because of what you just alluded to, that these three big pharmaceutical companies, in addition to their own direct investment, have each given $40 million to the state to create a $120 million biotech education fund, basically a biomanufacturing center and training center, TBD, but to be between Richmond and Charlottesville to train up this workforce. So we obviously envision being a big part of that, partnering with the community colleges, other regional universities. But it's going to come fast because when these folks are up and running, they're estimating somewhere from 2,000 to 2,500 people per year entering the workforce. So that's a lot. You know, I was in a meeting with yet a different company about a month and a half ago, and the fella kind of cut me off and said, I love your story, but we're going to need 200 PhDs. How many of those can a UVA source? And suffice it to say, just a small fraction of those. So we're really going to have to invest in the state and the basic education infrastructure, but also the kind of experiential training and workforce development center that we hope to be part of the Manning Institute. So lots to come.
Do you feel like there's a call also, because there's the people who are just entering undergraduate, and there's people kind of trying to decide after undergraduate, go industry, go keep learning and getting more of an education, getting a PhD. Is there also opportunities now for people who are out in the field and maybe, because one of the big discussions people are having is workforce is changing right now. Things like entry-level jobs and in some areas like data analytics or accounting or other things are going away with AI, and people are thinking, do I need to go and just do something completely different and reskill, learn a completely different field? Do you think there's opportunities for that as well for people who have been in the workforce to kind of pivot towards biotech or to repivot if maybe they've left it because they couldn't find jobs earlier?
I mean, that is certainly the vision, is to make those kind of on and off ramps as seamless and easy as possible. Because I think with the high demands coming into this region, number one, but two, with just the disruption that's naturally going to come from AI, we need people to be able to enter and leave the workforce for retraining and make it as easy as possible. Yeah, more to come. Early days, we're just starting to spec out our own plans of how we can do that. But everything from micro learnings to certificates to online stuff. I think for some of the things that we're talking about, you really do need that experiential hands-on training in the lab or in a biomanufacturing facility on specific equipment and technologies, because that's what the employers need and want.
Yeah, this is really good news for everybody who's in Virginia, but also anybody who's pursuing a career in biotech. If you end up moving to Virginia, it's a beautiful place. Beautiful place.
Yeah.
Lots of wineries and really good food in Charlottesville. So definitely good news. Okay, so last, I just want to ask, how do people get involved? Talent, treasure time, how do they contribute to your mission? Do you guys have job openings now? Like, what are all the things that people can do to be a part of this big idea?
Yeah. We had mentioned a little while ago, we're still in the fundraising mode. So again, if there's listeners that feel so inclined, you know, be grateful to that. There's plenty of philanthropy opportunities. I think the second thing is having a network of experts that could potentially advise and consult and mentor faculty and early startups. There will be a need for that. And that can be done either locally in person or virtually too. So we found for those early entrepreneurs, having a mentor and a coach is incredibly beneficial. And I think there's a lot of folks within the alumni network that have reached out and have offered their sort of expertise. You know, similar to that, as we start to develop a pipeline, having real venture investors be able to look at our portfolio and provide guidance and have the ability to either directly invest or partner folks or connect folks is super helpful. And then I think in the last one, it comes back to the education theme. I think there's opportunities in the larger university around scholarships, internships, et cetera, to give folks that experiential learning in the labs, which can then open the door to great, great careers.
Yeah. Great. So we're going to link Mark's email below. You can email him if you're interested in getting involved. We'll also link the Institute. And I love that book that you mentioned on Spark. So we'll also link that for anybody who's interested in learning about drug discovery process, maybe your early career, maybe you're in school right now and you just want to check that out and to see what that whole process looks like, maybe find your spot, your niche in biomedicine and biochemistry. Please check out those links. If you have a software that you develop or services that you provide for early stage biomedical companies, for research, for maybe electronic lab books, we are looking for sponsors and going into the future. We would love to partner with organizations and companies that are providing really valuable tools to researchers and scientists and be able to speak about you on the show. We want to keep things really focused on biomedical frontiers and the kind of amazing research and translation that's happening out there. But if you're part of that mission, we'd love to hear from you, and you can email us at biomedicalfrontiers@virginia.edu. Mark, it was such a pleasure having you on the show, and I'm so grateful that we were able to grab this time actually while you're still in the early stages of building the mission, the vision, the infrastructure, even the building and fundraising for the Paul and Dan Manning Institute of Biotechnology. And so very grateful to have you on the show and to hear about this work in progress.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is a pleasure. It's a pleasure to meet you and to be able to talk about the Manning Institute. And I'll say, looking to having a grand opening sometime in 2028. And let's make a date for me to come back and give you guys an update. That would be cool.
That's perfect. And of course, for anybody who follows us on social media, if you don't yet, follow us on Instagram or LinkedIn. We want to make sure you guys hear about these updates and also about the Shark Tank experience. We also talk about other opportunities, both at UVA, Virginia, and more broadly, including funding opportunities out there, anything that really serves translational biomedical research and innovation. So make sure you follow us. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for listening to Biomedical Frontiers, stories with innovators in healthcare. My name is David Chen, and I am the Managing Director of the Wallace H. Coulter Center for Translational Research at the University of Virginia. Our mission is to help bring promising new biomedical research and technology into the hands of the provider and the patient. If you found this episode valuable, please let us know by subscribing, following, or sharing. You can learn more about our promising translational research projects on our website. See links in the show notes.